behind us as we open is a Civil War tune played by a fine brass band, but not one that is instantly recognizable. It is Cheer, Boys, Cheer. And I thought we might start, James McPherson, on a sort of optimistic note. Cheer, boys, cheer. That's when they were going into war and they didn't quite know what was coming. I speak to my distinguished guest, who's here for a third visit. James McPherson is professor of history at Princeton University. All the country knows him as the author of Battle Cry of Freedom, one of the few works in history that has sold over a million copies, I believe, and for which he received the Pulitzer Prize. The new book is Crossroads of Freedom, Antietam, and we're shortly going to go to Maryland, just a little bit outside Washington, and talk about the Battle of Antietam. But I'm right, am I not, that when the war first began, there was great enthusiasm on both sides as the troops rushed forward?
You are quite right. Both sides rushed, men on both sides rushed to enlist. Many of them hoped that they would get into the war before it was over. Everybody expected a short war, and of course on both sides they expected a victorious war. Just about all the music in the first months of the war, even the first years of the war, was that upbeat march rhythm, cheer boys, cheer, encouraging the boys themselves in the army, but it was also for the home front.
And we'll rally around the flag, boys, we'll rally around the flag.
That's right. That was actually written in the summer of 1862, mm-hmm. In response to Lincoln's second call for three-year volunteers in July 1862. So it was an attempt to stimulate a renewed enthusiasm for enlisting, joining up to whip the rebels.
When the World War II began, there was a period, 4 or 5 months, that was called the Phony War, or Zitzkrieg rather than Blitzkrieg, where nothing much happened on the Western Front. And that isn't quite the way, or was there a Zitzkrieg period at the very beginning of the Civil War?
Well, the first major battle in the Civil War took place in July 1861, and that was 4 months after, May, June, 3 months mm-hmm. after the war had started. At Bull Run or Manassas, and there were some other minor battles in 1861, but in a sense there was a kind of a Sitzkrieg during almost a year of the war. There were operations, there were victories on both sides. The Northern forces managed to secure control of most of the border states, that is those slave states bordering the free states that did not secede. But it took a long time for both sides to mobilize in the war. At the outbreak of the war, the United States Army was 16,000 men, only 1,000 officers. They were scattered throughout the western territories and the frontier in small units. So there was no such thing as a large, sizable, well-trained army in either North and South capable of a sustained major campaign and major fighting. So the first year of the war was primarily mobilizing, organizing, and training these armies. They did get into some clashes, and the battle at First Manassas or Bull Run did involve about 20,000 troops on either side. But the fighting in 1861 paled in comparison with what happened in the last 3 years of the war.
Actually begins to seesaw, doesn't it? The Union does establish its dominance temporarily in some early victories, but then led by Lee, the Army of Northern Virginia comes north and produces some serious defeats.
Well, that's really what my book, Crossroads of Freedom, is about. In the early months of 1862, Northern forces enjoyed a remarkable string of victories, mostly in the Western Theater, as it was then called, mm-hmm. By which they gained control of the major river networks in the West, the Cumberland River, the Tennessee River, much of the Mississippi River. They also gained control of much of the South Atlantic coast, North Carolina coast, South Carolina coast, Georgia coast. And McClellan, the commander of the Army of the Potomac, invaded Virginia in April of 1862 and moved toward Richmond. And by the end of May 1862, his army was within hearing of the church bells of Richmond. They could see the churches. They were 5 miles away. And it looked like the Confederacy was about to succumb in May and June of 1862. But then you're quite right. Robert E. Lee took over as commander of the Army of Northern Virginia because its previous commander, Joseph Johnston, was wounded in a battle called Seven Pines on May 31st, 1862. And the combination of Lee and Jackson in that theater and Braxton Bragg in the Western Theater turned the war around in the summer of 1862.
They do very well at Second Manassas.
Yes, that's right. That was a spectacular victory.
And earlier, the 7 days.
It's called the 7 days. That's when the Army of Northern Virginia drove the Army of the Potomac away from Richmond. Mm-hmm. And that had a hugely negative impact on Northern public opinion. The North had thought the war was going to be over by the 4th of July because they had had so many of these victories. They'd gained control of so much territory. And they were confident that the Army of the Potomac was going to walk right into Richmond. And when that didn't happen, the disillusionment and despair in the North was all the greater because the expectations mm-hmm. had been so high.
And then the way forces or individuals somehow influence the course of events, and whether it's forces or individuals is one of the great questions. There are issues in historiographic theory that you do raise in this book and that I want to discuss with you shortly. But things are moving inexorably, because with hindsight it's always inexorable, towards a day of reckoning. And that day is September 17, 1862.
That's the day of the Battle of Antietam, near the village of Sharpsburg, just a couple of miles east of the Potomac River, the border between Maryland and Virginia, now West Virginia, but then Virginia, about 40 to 50 miles from Washington. Robert E. Lee, after his spectacular victory at Second Manassas, had to decide what to do next, and because he was on a roll and he thought that he had the Army of the Potomac on the ropes, decided to invade Maryland.
It's go for broke. Head towards Washington.
That's right. He couldn't attack the Washington defenses. They were too strong. So he headed up the Potomac River and crossed north of Washington, hoping to inflict yet another defeat on the Army of the Potomac. And if he could do that, he might just knock the North out of the war, force the Lincoln administration to sue for peace.
And there's that very prudent general, very popular with his troops, not too popular with his commander, Abraham Lincoln, George McClellan, who does once again rouse himself to action.
That's quite true. In the summer of 1862, Lincoln had grown increasingly disillusioned with McClellan because of his caution.
He could have taken Richmond if he had.
Yes, Lincoln thought he could have, and I think most historians think he could have too, but he constantly overestimated the number of enemy troops that he faced and then used that as an excuse for staying on the defensive rather than seizing the initiative and going on the
offensive. At one point, he gives Lincoln the excuse that, well, we can't go forward, our horses are tired.
That was, yes, that's right, and Lincoln, this is after Antietam, and Lincoln says, what has your cavalry done since the Battle of Antietam that would tire any horses? Lincoln had, by that time, grown totally disgusted with McClellan.
But with the Army of Northern Virginia heading across Maryland towards Washington, obviously McClellan has to come out and play again, and he does.
McClellan is the one general who had the confidence of the troops in the Army of the Potomac, and Lincoln knew that, even though he himself had lost confidence, or at least had lost some confidence with McClellan. He knew that McClellan was the only one who could revive the morale. They pretty much beaten down morale of the Army of the Potomac. And so he put McClellan back in command of the Army of the Potomac and some troops from other smaller armies, and ordered him to meld them into the Army of the Potomac and to go after the Army of Northern Virginia. And as Lincoln said it in one telegram he sent to McClellan, destroy the rebel army if possible.
And he doesn't destroy it, but he certainly injures it very significantly, but his own army is very significantly injured. I was stunned by the historical fact that you emphasize in the book, that more American men were lost, that is counting both Northern and Southern troops, more American soldiers were killed and maimed at Antietam than, you finish the sentence.
Well, in all of the rest of the wars fought by this country in the 19th century combined.
Not in individual battles, but if you take all the wars
the War of 1812.
Excluding the Civil War.
Excluding the Civil War, if you take the actual battle deaths, in American battle deaths in the War of 1812, the Mexican-American War, and the Spanish-American War, and the Indian Wars, the other wars this country fought in the 19th century, more soldiers were killed at Antietam than in all of those other wars combined.
It's about 62 to 6,300.
That's right.
Over 6,000.
Yes.
Whereas if you look at D-Day and the American losses on D-Day invading France, it's only about 1,500, isn't
it? That's right. The total number of casualties at Antietam, if you include the wounded, were about 23,000, and the total number of American casualties on D-Day were about 6,000. That includes the wounded as well as the dead.
Why and how was it that bloody?
Well, Civil War battles were fought at close range. They were fought by massed armies that lined up shoulder to shoulder and fought in a line, just as they'd done in the Napoleonic Wars. And the Antietam battlefield, which is very well preserved and is very much worth a visit, is relatively small. So you had a total of about 100,000 men within a fairly confined space fighting intensively over a period of about 12 or 13 hours of daylight on that September 17th.
How confined is the space?
Well, it's about 1 mile by 5 miles in the area where the fighting took place.
So what was the size of the two armies as they confronted one another?
Well, McClellan's army, the Army of the Potomac, was about 80,000 men.
80,000.
And Lee started north with between 50 and 50,000.
But he loses a number of deserters, doesn't he?
Well, they were called stragglers. Yeah. Some of them probably were deserters. But that army had been marching and fighting with inadequate supplies and with no rest for nearly 3 months. A lot of the men didn't have shoes. They didn't have adequate food. And many of them dropped out on the way, maybe because they were deserters, maybe because they were cowards. But I think in many cases because they were physically exhausted.
But he does lose some 10,000 marching to the battle.
He loses about 10,000 stragglers. He loses some men in the preliminary battles before Antietam at South Mountain on September 14th.
But roughly it's about 80,000 against 40,000.
That's correct. McClellan never uses 20,000 of his 80,000. That's one of the major facts of the battle. He kept men in reserve and did not use them.
What's the ordnance like? Is there much heavy artillery, or is it mostly rifles?
Well, the field artillery are mostly 12-pound Napoleon bronze guns. That is, they fire a 12-pound cannonball or shell, or what were called 10-inch ordnance rifles. They would fire, I mean, 3-inch ordnance rifle, I'm sorry, they'd fire a 10-pound shell. Anything bigger than that was not mobile enough to travel with an army. So that's the artillery. But in a battle like Antietam and many other battles in the Civil War, the artillery is an important but not decisive factor in the battle. What's really important is the infantry.
It's man-to-man, hand-to-hand.
It's man-to-man, not so much hand-to-hand, but men with rifles
shooting
standing anywhere from 50 to 200 or 300 yards apart.
In those days, the artillery shells did not yet contain shrapnel, did they?
Well, some of them did in a crude way. They didn't always call it shrapnel. They would have a fuse. The fuse was cut to a certain length so that, and it's the ordnance sergeant's, the gunnery sergeant's estimate at what length it would need to be cut, so that it would explode over enemy troops and the shell, the casing of the shell, would form a kind of shrapnel. But often those shells did not explode on time, or they didn't explode at all, they exploded too early. So shrapnel, in the sense that we're familiar with in modern wars, was pretty ineffective in the Civil War.
Apart from the great movement of massive armies and the large political issues and the world looking on, because that's the way we tell the Civil War story, but there are incidents, there are strange happenstances or matters of accident upon which a whole battle might turn. Are you convinced, or do you just entertain the speculation that the discovery of the envelope with the three cigars might have directed the nature of that battle?
That extraordinary event did make a difference. It could have made a greater difference because McClellan did not take as much advantage of as he might have. But that really was one of the most extraordinary coincidences in the whole history of the Civil War, or maybe all of the military
history. Well, do tell the story.
Well,
it involves a Corporal Mitchell.
That's right. When Lee invaded Maryland, he expected the Union forces to withdraw from Harper's Ferry. There were about a garrison there of about 12,000 men. They did not withdraw. They were athwart Lee's line of communication with the Shenandoah Valley, so he decided when his army was at Frederick, Maryland, on September 9th, that he must capture this garrison in his rear now in Harper's Ferry before he could continue his invasion. So on September 9th, he issued Special Orders 191, to all of the corps and some of the division commanders in his army, telling them what to do. Some of them would converge on Harper's Ferry to capture it. Some of them would hold the passes in the South Mountain. And the Confederate Army moved out of Frederick on September 10th to begin this campaign. The Union Army came in a couple of days later, September 12th and 13th, and an Indiana regiment camped in a field on September 13th near Frederick, and a corporal in that regiment named Barton Mitchell happened to notice an envelope lying in the grass along the fence line, and he was curious, so he went over and picked it up, pulled out a piece of paper with three cigars, wrapped around three cigars. Curious. So he opened the paper, sent off a buddy to find a match so they could smoke the cigars, and he opened the paper and looked at it, and it was a copy of Lee's Special Orders number 191, detailing all of the positions and missions of the entire Confederate Army. What had happened was that Lee had issued multiple copies of this. Couriers went to each of the commanders in the Confederate Army. One of those couriers lost somewhere. Nobody knows. Nobody ever admitted it. Lost that copy of the orders. And it was never discovered by the Confederates because this was the orders. These were the orders that were to go to Daniel Harvey Hill, a division commander. Hill had just been attached to the Army of Northern Virginia. He came under Stonewall Jackson's command. But Lee's adjutant had issued separate orders to Hill. Those were the orders that were lost. When Jackson got his orders and noticed that Hill was assigned a special task, he made a copy of the orders for Hill and had them sent to Hill. So Hill received those orders. He received the orders from Jackson, but not the one from Lee's headquarters. Well, nobody ever knew that those orders were lost.
How soon does this get to McClellan?
Well, they're found in the morning, September 13th. It goes right up the chain of command, and McClellan sends a telegram to Lincoln at noon on September 13th saying, I have the plans of the rebels, and I'll catch them in their own trap.
It's like the Brits getting the Enigma machine.
That's exactly right, except it happened in just a couple of hours in this case. But then McClellan, who had evidence that these orders were genuine, not a hoax, delays 6 hours before he decides what to do and does not send the first orders to his own troops to march to attack the passes in South Mountain until 6 p.m. that evening. But when are they to march? Right away? No, tomorrow morning. So the first Union troops do not move until 18 hours after McClellan has received these orders. Now, it makes a big difference because he's able to push through those South Mountain passes before before Jackson has captured Harper's Ferry. And it looks to Lee like his invasion is ruined and he's about to pull back to Virginia, but then he receives word from Jackson that Harper's Ferry is about to fall, so Lee decides to stay and fight. But without finding those orders, McClellan probably would not have found Lee and attacked him as soon as he did, but McClellan did not move as quickly as he might have.
You remember the famous comment by Abba Ibn about Yasser Arafat. He never misses an opportunity to miss an opportunity.
Well, that'd be a great example.
Does that apply to McClellan, do you think?
That applies to McClellan because there were many other examples of the same thing happening on September 17th. Union forces achieved a breakthrough at the famous Bloody Lane on the Antietam battlefield about 1 p.m. McClellan didn't send in his reserves to exploit that breakthrough because he assumed that Lee was fighting that battle with 100,000 men. And therefore Lee had these huge reserves massed behind his lines who would eat up any reserves that McClellan sent in. And later in the afternoon, he does the same thing again. He misses another opportunity.
It is interesting that the whole battle is indeed fought through in one day. Some of the Civil War battles are extended over 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, Gettysburg is a good example, a three-day battle.
How was it all resolved in just that one day, September 17th?
Well, when the sun went down on September 17th, nobody realized that the battle was over. And in fact, most men on both sides expected to start up again in the morning. And in fact, McClellan sends a telegram to General Halleck in Washington, the general-in-chief, at about 8 o'clock in the morning saying, I expect to renew the attack today. And Lee expected to receive a continuation of the attack and had put his troops in a defensive position. But then McClellan decides, no, I'm not going to do it after all. And so both armies stay in position on September 18th, some of them still expecting that maybe the battle will be renewed any time, any minute during the course of the day. But it isn't, and that night Lee decides that he better get out while he's still...
Lee withdraws, and McClellan does not pursue, which he...
Not seriously.
Another opportunity that he missed.
Another opportunity lost, I think. He does not seriously pursue.
You conjecture that if he had pursued, he could have destroyed the army, possibly destroyed the Army of Northern Virginia, and thus, in essence, have won the war.
Yes, and certainly Lincoln thought so. A number of historians think so. But it was just not in McClellan's nature. He always played it safe. He felt he had won a great victory, that he had saved the Union, mm-hmm. he had saved the Northern cause from imminent collapse, and maybe he was right about that. He didn't want to, he was not a risk taker. Having won a limited victory, he did not want to risk turning it into a defeat by pushing even harder.
Somehow he reminds me of Colin Powell.
In the Gulf War?
In the Gulf War, and in, with a sort of prudent reserve that Powell shows even to this day as a former military, now Secretary of State.
Well, that's an interesting comparison. I hadn't thought about that.
But it was so bloody and dreadful mm-hmm. a battle. We've referred to the 6,000 killed, the many more maimed, and many more must have died in earlier than they would have otherwise. By virtue
yes, and
of
no,
their
and we have no way of knowing about how yeah. many people died younger than they would have because they suffered an amputated leg or something like that.
Here is something that I'd love to ask you to read. It's just a paragraph from your introductory chapter, and it brings the bloodiness of that dreadful occasion down to just a few men, but it is vivid and horrifying.
Stark memories of Antietam haunted many for the rest of their days. A private in the 1st Delaware, which suffered 230 casualties in the battle, recalled a Union soldier, quote, stumbling around with both eyes shot out, begging someone, for the love of God, to put an end to his misery, end quote. A nearby lieutenant asked him if he really meant what he said. Oh, yes, the blinded soldier replied. I cannot possibly live, and my agony is unendurable. Without another word, the lieutenant drew his revolver, placed it to the victim's right ear, turned away his head, and pulled the trigger. A half wheel, a convulsive gasp, and one more unfortunate had passed over to the silent majority. It was better thus, said the lieutenant, replacing his pistol and turning toward me, for the poor fellow could... Just then, a solid shot took the lieutenant's head off.
What a moment.
What a moment.
What a horror.
Yes, and can you imagine living with that memory the rest of your life?
Mm. Yeah. One can go in many directions with this, but let's go first in the obvious direction. The consequences of this victory were, as you said a moment ago, possibly the salvation of the Union.
Well, Northern morale, both in the armies, but even more important on the home front, was at rock bottom after Second Manassas and in the early days of Lee's invasion of Maryland, because not only was this going on in Maryland, but a Confederate army had invaded Kentucky. And so you had the two principal Confederate armies invading two key border states at the same time. And it looked like this was the Confederacy's supreme bid to conquer a peace to conquer their independence on northern soil.
Well, play that through in terms of alternative tracks in history, which are of intrinsic interest as one conjectures about history and the what-ifs of history. And I know that has a special fascination for you, mm-hmm. as I confess it has for me as an amateur interested in history. What if somehow, what if they hadn't found the three cigars?
They hadn't found the three
and the
cigars.
Plan.
Well,
might that have turned it in the other, it's the other
possible.
Direction?
It's possible. Lee went north looking for a battle. Yeah. He had beaten the Army of the Potomac twice at the 7 days, and at Second Manassas, although at Second Manassas it wasn't just the Army, it was only part of the Army of the
Second
Potomac.
Manassas is also Bull Run.
Yes, so it's the same, two sides give that particular battle different right. names. So he was looking for the knockout punch, number three and out on this. And if McClellan had not found those orders, there would have been a battle somewhere in Maryland. It probably wouldn't have been near Sharpsburg on Antietam Creek, and maybe it would have come in circumstances that gave the Confederates a victory.
And if they had had a victory in that battle, what were the further consequences?
Well, one thing we can be sure of is that the British and French would have intervened with an offer to mediate a peace between the two sides on the basis of Confederate independence.
They'd been watching closely, and indeed the British especially, at least the ruling elites, had a particular, were leaning towards the Confederacy.
Well, they were leaning toward recognizing Confederate independence.
Yeah. To resume their cotton shipments, supposedly.
To resume cotton was one of the big factors in that. Also, the British regarded themselves as the world's policemen in the same way we do today, Pax Britannica. And this war in the Western Hemisphere was something that the British thought that, as the leading power in the world, they could play a role in bringing to an end. They thought the Union cause was hopeless. And they thought that the North would finally recognize that if Lee's invasion resulted in one more victory. So Prime Minister Palmerston and Foreign Secretary Lord John Russell said that we should strike when the iron is hot. And when Lee was forced to retreat to Virginia, and when a couple of weeks later the Confederate army that had invaded Kentucky was forced to retreat to Tennessee, the British backed off. The French still wanted to go ahead, but the British backed off, and that's the closest the Confederates ever got to European recognition and some kind of intervention.
The other major consequence, apparently, was that Lincoln, who had the Emancipation Proclamation in his pocket, so to speak, finally felt he could pronounce it to the world.
That's right. Lincoln had made a decision the previous July that the way the North had been fighting this war, a limited war to restore the old Union, and not taking advantage of the potential manpower of the black population in the South, was not working. And since he was personally anti-slavery and his party was an anti-slavery party, he decided to expand the purpose and the meaning and the scope of the war. So he had drafted an Emancipation Proclamation using his powers as commander-in-chief, his war powers, as commander-in-chief in time of war to seize enemy property being used to wage war against the United States. Slaves were enemy property. To declare those slaves free, to seize them, to confiscate them, and free them. But his cabinet, and especially Secretary of State Seward, persuaded Lincoln that if he issued this proclamation when Northern armies were going backwards and when things were going badly, that it would look like our last shriek on the retreat. It would look, it wouldn't carry any moral force. It wouldn't carry any impetus. So Lincoln put that proclamation away in a drawer to wait for a more propitious time after Union victory to give it that kind of impetus. And Antietam, he seized upon Antietam as the victory he had been waiting for and issued that proclamation 5 days later.
I come to something that I've noted a few times. I want to draw you into this now, and I know that you think about this and have a very distinctive view on the question of contingency in history. Putting it another way, a way that I've often used on this program is that one can consider counterfactuals. What if something had happened otherwise? What would the consequences have been, not merely for the immediate issue, but for all the following unfolding of related history? A few years ago, John Keegan was here, the eminent British military historian, and we got into talking about, I guess when he had his book about battles, or one of his books on battles, we were talking about Waterloo. And it is commonly conjectured that if the Prussians had delayed still further in coming to the aid of Wellington, Napoleon might have won, probably would have won, the Battle of Waterloo. And I said to Keegan, kind of excited with all of this, the mind reels with what the consequences would have been, a restoration of the Napoleonic Empire. And Keegan chuckled and said, not at all. If he had won that battle, he would have lost the next battle a month or two later. He could not possibly have won. All of Europe was arrayed against him. His forces were weak. All he got himself, he would have only have earned for himself an extra 2 or 3 months at the most. Do you agree?
Well, in that particular case, I do agree, because the Russians and the Austrians had also joined the coalition against Napoleon. And if he had won Waterloo against the British and the Prussians, or against the British without the Prussians coming to their aid, the Austrians and the Russians would have still probably been sufficient to crush him. But in the case of Antietam in the American Civil War, if that had gone the other way, there were no Russians and Austrians waiting in the wings to help the Union cause.
Years ago, there was a book I read, a fictional book, in which relates to Gettysburg rather than to Antietam, but the South wins and they win the war. And the book by a Southern novelist, I forget now what his name was, is titled Bring the Jubilee. And it has the South winning the Civil War and then traces the history of the United States for the next 100 years or so. Or rather, the history of the Confederacy mm-hmm. and the United States. They go their separate ways. The Confederacy becomes a great power by virtue of its victory. Ultimately, they rejoin.
Well, any number of scenarios are possible in one's imagination, yeah. but it is quite true that I think if the Confederacy had achieved its independence, it probably would have remained a separate country for a long time. Whether there would have been a reunification is anybody's guess.
Slavery would have ended inevitably sooner or later.
Sooner or later it would have ended, but not as soon as it did.
Yeah. But let me read you something. We're going shortly to commercials, but this is sort of a tease to get us through those commercials. I'd love to have your response to this as laid out in a book review that appeared in the Tribune just a few years ago. It's a review of a book titled Explaining Hitler, The Search for the Origins of His Evil, the book by Ron Rosenbaum. And the reviewer says, in the last year of the First World War, a German corporal, injured in a gas attack, is being led toward the field hospital. An artillery barrage begins, and one shell detonates directly on the wounded soldier and his two rescuers. All three are instantly killed. This account is only half true. Adolf Hitler was gassed and debilitated. That the artillery barrage did not land on him raises a compelling question. What if it had? With no Hitler thrashing about in Munich in the early 1920s, would the Nazi Party have risen? Would it have gone on to murder, lie, and rabble-rouse down the route to power? Without Hitler, would the Second World War have occurred? And, to come to one of the crucial mysteries addressed by Rosenbaum in this new book, without Hitler, would the Holocaust have been enacted?
Mm-hmm.
The reviewer goes on to quote an article by Milton Himmelfarb some years ago, which gives an answer to that question. The title of the article was No Hitler, No Holocaust. Mm. The role of the individual and the ultimate contingency of whether the individual is withdrawn from history earlier than, in fact, he was.
Mm-hmm.
It's that I think we might go on to in terms of more general theory. And when we return to James McPherson, right after we pause for these words. That has always seemed to me, the Hitler matter, a fine illustration of the counterfactual. If Hitler had not appeared on the historic scene, but had been killed in World War I, it does seem sort of obvious that the rest of European history would have been rather different.
Yeah, it's a very plausible argument. I think there's no doubt about it that Hitler was probably the key person in shaping 20th century history. I don't think anybody could deny that. There certainly would have been a lot of discontent, unrest, violence and protest in Germany in the 1920s and 30s. The veterans that formed these Freikorps groups, and there would have been some kind of fascist movement in Germany, as there was in Italy, and there would have been conflicts between the socialists on one side and the fascists on the other. But without Hitler, it does seem fairly inconceivable that we would have had the course of events that took place after 1933.
Yeah, that the Nazis quite possibly would not have come to power.
That's quite true.
Or wouldn't have been Nazis. He sort of invented them as well.
Yeah.
He was the 12th member of the party.
Right.
But he reshaped them to his own fantasy. Well, is there anything comparable with regard to the Civil War?
Well, I think you could make a very strong argument that without Abraham Lincoln, the North would not have been able to sustain this war.
Or might not have girded itself up to do a war.
That's quite true. I think that Lincoln is the decisive actor in the Civil War. His decisions shaped the course of the war. From the very beginning, when he decides to resupply Fort Sumter, to the very end of the war. And his assassination was a tragedy in the sense that it altered the course of Reconstruction, I think, in a negative way.
You've done so much work on the Civil War, and you are generally considered to be the dean of Civil War historians in the country, indeed in the world. You must have, at some point, asked yourself, did Lincoln do the right thing, or should he have let the South go?
Well, I have asked myself that, and people have asked me that. And I don't think there's any yes or no answer to that question. If he had let the South go, it's quite possible there would not have been a war. On the other hand, there might have been a war over some issue of territorial control or conflict between these now two independent countries. The reason he didn't, and the reason that most northern people, I mean, he was supported by the northern polity in this. It was not just Lincoln's single-minded determination. He had the support of most of the northern people. They felt that if any state or region can secede from the United States at will, that there would be no United States. If it can happen once, it would happen again, and there would be, that North America would look like South America. That the whole experiment, which Americans regarded as a holy experiment of 1776, when Americans of the generation of the 1860s looked back on what they considered to be the greatest generation, it was the generation of the founding fathers, and they felt that this was the great test, as Lincoln said in his Gettysburg Address, whether the nation the founding fathers had created could survive, and whether they in the 1860s were worthy of that heritage.
What did the war cost totally in lives? The largest bloodletting was on that fateful day at Antietam, but when you reckon up all of the casualties?
Well, the total number of dead was at least 620,000, probably more. One way to get our minds around that is to recognize that it was 2% of the American population. Mm-hmm. 2% of the American population were to die in a war fought today, the number of American war dead would be 5.5 million. So that was that gives you some idea of the cost of that war in terms of human lives. Now, I mean, the real question is, would Lincoln have made the decisions he did make in 1861 if he had known that the war would cost 620,000 lives? And that's an unanswerable question.
What do we know about how he sustained himself in the face of all the tragedy that was unfolding in consequence of his decision?
Well, one thing we do know, I mean, there are a lot of things about that we don't know, and it's one of the great mysteries about Lincoln, but one thing we do know is that he became increasingly religious as the war went on. And if you read carefully his second inaugural address, it's very much like a sermon.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a meditation on God's will in this war. And I think Lincoln had come to the conclusion partway through the war, he was something of a fatalist, and he had come to the conclusion that this war was willed by God as punishment of the American people, which Lincoln called his almost chosen people, for the sin of slavery.
He very often calls God providence, doesn't he?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which has about it the stamp of inevitability.
Yeah.
God is... It's really a rather Calvinist notion of God.
Well, he was brought up in a Calvinist tradition in a Baptist Calvinist church in the 1820s. He departed from that. He was a free thinker for a while. He never joined the church, but I think under the pressures of the war and the suffering and the death, he became increasingly religious, and that, I think, helped to sustain him.
Well, there's Lincoln, a great historical actor. Without him, just as without Hitler, history would have unfolded in very different terms, though I'm not comparing the two, except that they both had strong historical influence. Without the obscure corporal from Wisconsin, who found those war orders, that battle, and thus the war, might have turned differently.
That's quite true.
Which raises the question that I've been deferring for a while, but as I've said a number of times, I'm quite fascinated by it. The role of contingency in history. Contingency is a good word. It kind of stands in the middle between two clearly different modes of philosophy of history. One is the great man theory of history. Carlyle represents it most directly. Even Churchill echoed that view. History is nothing but the record of the doings of great historical actors, says Carlyle. The other, of course, is the Marxian, and more generally the social forces view, the Hegelian Marxian view, that history has about it inevitability. Mm-hmm. It seizes particular actors to do its work, but it would have ground on in the same direction even without Hitler, even without Lincoln, one could say.
Well, and I think you're right. The contingency stands between these.
Explain how it does that.
Well, there are many examples from the Antietam campaign or from the Civil War. Just to back up and take another example, if Joseph Johnston has not been wounded on May 31st at Seven Pines and Robert E. Lee had not become commander of the Army of Northern Virginia in his place, Johnston, who was very defensive-minded, would have fought a very different kind of campaign, and the whole course of the war We can't know in what ways, but the whole course of the war might well have been different. So there is an event, almost an accidental event, the wounding of Johnston, which brings in a different historical actor with different ideas how to fight this war, and changes the course of the war. In the end, the Confederacy loses, but it might have lost in 1862 if Lee had not taken over, and therefore there would have been far fewer changes in the course of in the social structure of the South. So that's an event that was contingent, a process that was contingent upon a particular event that was not foreordained. I mean, it'd be hard to make the argument that the bullet that wounded Johnston in the shoulder was somehow directed by God or by some inanimate force that made it inevitable from the dawn of history. So I think that the idea of contingency is that all things are open at all times. Nothing is foreordained. Nothing is inevitable. People make choices, and sometimes chance, fortune, luck enters into the course of history in a way that nobody could predict. And the historian needs to understand the power of this contingency and to recognize that it might actually change the course of events.
You speak about the bullet that wounded Johnston. There's another very significant bullet in April of 1865 at Ford's Theater that killed, though it wasn't the bullet that killed him, it was John Wilkes Booth.
Who pulled
the trigger. But still, what if there's Lincoln shot in the head and he dies within, is it one day or 2 days?
Well, he died the next morning.
The next morning. What if Booth had missed?
Well, I think the course of American history might have been quite different.
A post-Civil War period with Lincoln in command, how would it have played?
Well, for one thing, there would not have been the schism between President and Congress that dominated the history of Reconstruction in the first 3 years and led to the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, who was Lincoln's successor. Lincoln and Congress would have worked together to formulate a Reconstruction policy. Lincoln would not have misled white Southerners about what was to be required of them in order to return to the Union and to provide equal citizenship for the freed slaves. I think one thing that happened with Johnson, Andrew Johnson as president, was that because he resisted congressional reconstruction, he held out the hope to the South that they had the President of the United States on their side if they in resisting the policy of Congress to grant equal rights to the freed slaves and to impose other kinds of conditions and coming back. That would never have happened. And I think there would have been less violence, less bitterness, less hatred in Reconstruction than there was.
There are even reverberations of that hatred down to this day, I think.
Surely.
Do you agree?
Yes. You still find it in certain corners of the South, no question about that. That's one of the that's one of the things that fueled the Confederate, or still does fuel the Confederate flag issue today.
Mm-hmm.
The whole question of Confederate heritage and what the Confederacy stood for, and whether that flag stands for slavery and racism, or whether it stands for courage and honor, and the doomed effort or the failed effort of a noble people to achieve their own independence.
There's a bunch of sort of agrarian intellectuals, if one wanted to find a name for them, who are Southern in origin or in reference, who've organized themselves, they did this some years ago, into something called the League of the South. Do you know them?
I've read something about the League of the South, and I encounter some of their publications from now time to time.
Are they really looking for a reestablishment of the Confederacy?
Well, there are some lunatic fringe, maybe I shouldn't put it quite that strong, some fringe elements in there that really do seriously want to do that. But I think for the most part, they want to kind of create a cultural identity for Confederate heritage in the South.
And it's a pure Anglo-Saxon, non-industrialized South.
Well, it's curious. I don't know if they have any black members. There are a number of blacks who have identified themselves with the Confederate heritage groups.
Yeah.
And I've never quite understood where they're coming from, but there are a few.
History is just so fascinating a discipline, and finally, it's clearly, well, I don't know. I'm stammering just a bit because there's so many questions on my mind. I love talking about these things, and to have an eminent historian to bounce these ideas off of, or rather to get his response to one's own confusions, is a great boon. Is it possible to have an objective history? Von Ranke, whom I often quote, said the task of the historian is very simple: tell everything the way it really happened.
Well, at one time, I think historians thought that they could do that. I think it was Leopold von Ranke, the famous German historian in the 19th century, who said precisely that.
Alles erzählen, wie es eigentlich gewesen war.
Exactly. Most historians don't accept that now. I mean, historians are human beings. They have, they're shaped by their own world, by their own culture, by their own upbringing, by their own series of overlapping identities having to do with religion and ethnicity and region and language and culture. And so they bring this baggage to the events of the past. And there's just no way that we can assume that we're telling exactly what happened in the past. It's just, historians are fallible human beings.
Well, if you look at Civil War history as it's been written since, say, the 1870s down to the present moment, have there been periods in which a different vision of the war has dominated?
Oh, yes. I think that for the first generation or so after the war, the northern, victorious northern vision of the war tended to dominate. Starting around 1900, there was a revival of a sort of southern perception of these things. And over time, and I think probably down to the 1960s, the southern version of the war became increasingly powerful in national perception of the war, and also of the post-war Reconstruction settlement. I suppose gone with the two movies, two of the most influential movies in the entire 20th century, Birth of a Nation in 1915 and Gone with the Wind in 1939, present an essentially Southern point of view on the war and Reconstruction, and I think that reflects the dominant view of even many historians during that period. And then the Civil Rights Revolution in the 1960s introduced brought it more, not full circle necessarily, but part of the circle back to an earlier view of Northern triumph, the triumph of good and of right.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we've come back to that point of view in a more sophisticated way than it existed right after the war.
One has the impression that Civil War buffery, so to speak, is a major industry and will be forever. That though we have interest in all sorts of other wars that America has participated in, the Civil War is the one that really engages the interests of millions of people.
Well, that's absolutely true. There are something like 400 Civil War roundtables mm-hmm. in this country, and while there is now a movement, I think, for World War II roundtables, there are only a handful. There's nothing like that phenomenon for anything else. There are said to be 40 or 50,000 Civil War reenactors. And you'll see several thousand of them in movies like Gettysburg or The Gods and Generals, which is coming out next month, I believe, now. Yes, it's caught hold of the American psyche in a way that no other historical experience in our past has done.
I suppose there must have been a number of reenactments of the Battle of Antietam.
Yes, in fact, there was just, I mean, last September was the 140th anniversary of mm-hmm. it, and there was a big reenactment, yep.
Did you go down there?
Well, I didn't actually see any of the reenactment. I was at the reenactment took place about 5 or 6 miles from the actual battlefield. The National Park Service doesn't allow mm-hmm. reenactments in the park itself. I was down for National Park Service was having a series of lectures and programs, and I gave one of the lectures and did a lot of book signing. But I didn't get out to see the reenactment.
We are going to pause in a moment and take care of a quick update on the evening's news. Also, it is time to invite telephone calls.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vengeance where the grace of wrath was stored. He has loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible sword. His truth is marching on. Roar.
that's probably the single song, James McPherson, that virtually at best represents the Civil War, don't you think?
Well, I think so. That and Lincoln's Gettysburg Address are the two things that we think of when we think about the more noble aspects of the Civil War, the meaning of the sacrifice that so many people made to achieve national union and freedom.
Interesting, the role of certain women in the Civil War. Those words were written by Julia Ward Howe.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
And when Harriet Beecher Stowe came to the White House, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, what was the comment by Lincoln?
Lincoln said, "So you're the little woman who wrote the big book that made this great war."
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it may have.
It certainly played a role in it. Yes, it may. Yeah. It contributed to the sectional conflict of the 1850s that led to war.
The run-up to the war is something that we haven't talked about tonight, but there were two decades of extreme agitation, weren't there?
Well, you could argue that it went even farther back than that. The Missouri Compromise of 1820 raised many of the same issues that they were debating in the 1850s. So that is the whether slavery should be allowed to expand beyond its original territories, and that was the issue that eventually brought on the war. That was at stake in 1820. It was at stake in the annexation of Texas in 1845. It was at stake in the debate about what to do about slavery in the territories acquired from Mexico in the Mexican War. And it was at stake in the debates about whether slavery should be allowed to go into Kansas in the mid-1850s. So that was an issue that had roiled up American society and American politics for 40 years. It intensified even more from the Mexican War right on down to 1861.
It is really staggering when one remembers how many men were killed in that war as compared to all the other conflicts that we've engaged in. We lost fewer men in World War II, didn't we?
That's true, about 450,000 compared to 620,000 in the Civil War, in a much bigger country, of course.
Of course. That's a much smaller proportion of our total population.
Mm-hmm.
We are looking forward to your phone calls. A number of emails have arrived, but we're ready to receive phone calls directly, and as they come in, we'll turn you over to James McPherson. The number 591-7200, 591-7200, 312, the area code if you're calling long distance. And let me just bring up one of these. Here we go. I really enjoyed your interview with James McPherson. Well, it isn't finished yet. this is somebody emailing us from Baltimore, as it happens. If you get this while you are still on the air, ask him about the question of blacks who may have fought for the South. In Dudley Cornish's 1956 book on black soldiers, The Sable Arm, he mentions that in the fall of 1861, those calling for the use of black troops by the North said that the South was already arming blacks and using them against the United States. Is that true?
It's not really true that the South was using them in 1861, but those rumors were circulating in the North. Some members of the free colored community, as it was called, in New Orleans in 1861, did offer their services to the Confederacy and were organized as a militia group. And during the course of the war, there were thousands and thousands of slaves with the Confederate armies. The Confederate armies would not have been able to operate without the support of the labor power of the slaves. They functioned as teamsters, as laborers, as cooks, as servants for officers.
They came along to serve their masters.
That's right. And in a number of occasions, there's pretty good evidence that they may have taken up arms in the heat of the battle. But not until March of 1865, when the war was almost over, did the Confederate Congress finally, after much debate and a very close division, finally pass a bill authorizing the enlistment of a certain number of blacks in the Confederate Army. Up until that time, if there had been any fighting in the Confederate Army, it was ad hoc and on a very small basis, no more than a few hundred altogether. And the bill that passed in March 1865 never really went into effect because the war was over.
Is the film based upon, what was the name of the unit that Colonel Shaw?
Oh, Glory. It's the 54th Massachusetts.
Is the film Glory a fairly accurate representation?
It is reasonably accurate for a Hollywood movie, yeah. They got some things, little things wrong, but I think they got the big things right.
Mm-hmm. We'll go to the phones. 591-7200 is the number. And here is the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening. Do they have estimates for civilian casualties from the Civil War, or was the battlefield more of a battlefield nature than a city and small-town conflict?
As I remember, for some of the early battles, people came out from Washington to sort of stand on the heights and watch the battle.
Well, that was true at the first Battle of Bull Run or Manassas.
Yeah.
They came out hoping to see something. They didn't close enough to really see anything, but some of them were caught in the backwash of the Union retreat. None of those people suffered any casualties in that battle. In a few of the battles, there were civilian casualties. In the Siege of Vicksburg, for example, about 3,000 civilians remained in Vicksburg, and some of them were injured or even killed by shell fire. The same thing was true at Atlanta. Of course, in the Battle of Gettysburg, Jenny Wade was baking biscuits in her kitchen when she was hit by a chance bullet that came through her kitchen door. So there were some civilian casualties in the course of the war, but we're talking about a handful compared to modern wars, where the civilians are part of the actual war front. The one thing we don't know is how many civilians, and this would have been primarily in the South, suffered from an early death because they were weakened by malnutrition, mm-hmm. and therefore more susceptible to disease. A lot of Southern civilians did not have enough to eat in the course as the war went on because of shortages occasioned by breakdowns in transportation, primarily in the South. There were a couple of 100,000 white refugees who left their homes and moved elsewhere, and they probably suffered a lot. A lot of slaves who made their way from their plantations into Union lines and were gathered together in contraband villages or contraband camps suffered from some epidemic diseases that went through those camps. So we're talking about several thousand people, nobody knows for sure how many, civilians who probably died earlier than they would have from these various kinds of disease, mostly.
Would there have been some direct war deaths by civilians when Sherman marched through Georgia or any of the other punitive campaigns in the South?
Not very many direct deaths. Sherman and other Union commanders who destroyed Confederate property did not try to go after civilian persons. But there may have been some indirect deaths, because one of the things that Sherman and Sheridan in the Shenandoah Valley did was to destroy all the crops that might sustain Confederate military forces, and that meant that a lot of civilians were going to go hungry too, because all the food in the area had been destroyed.
The phone number, 591-7200, for anything you ever wanted to ask about the Civil War but didn't know who to ask. The man to ask is surely James McPherson, who is commonly credited as being our most distinguished Civil War historian of the present time. 591-7200. If you want to email us a question, the email address, again, extension 720, one word, @tribune.com. And here is another call. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I had a question about had Lincoln lived. I don't remember where I read it, but he was talking like repatriating the slaves back to Africa, and I believe there was a purchase of the colony of Liberia in Africa. And also, correct me if I'm wrong, the purchase of the island of Hispaniola, which I believe now has the Dominican Republic and Haiti on there.
Well, you've got some of the facts right, but the timing on some of these things is wrong. The Liberia was established in the 1840s by the American Colonization Society, which had been encouraging the emigration of free or freed blacks from the United States since the 1820s. Lincoln didn't have anything directly to do with that. After the war, during Ulysses Grant's administration, the United States did actually negotiate a treaty for the annexation of what is today the Dominican Republic. It was called Santo Domingo then. They would have become a United States territory if that treaty had been ratified by the Senate. But it was not, and again, Lincoln didn't have anything to do with that. Lincoln did support, up until 1862 or 1863, the idea that the colonization abroad of freed slaves might make emancipation more acceptable to many of the northern and indeed perhaps some of the southern people. But once the Lincoln administration made a commitment to not only freedom but also the enlistment of black soldiers to fight for the Union and the recruitment of black workers to work for the Union Army, he backed away from colonization and never said anything more about it after early 1863.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
We thank you, sir, for the call.
All right. Thanks,
another email query. How important was the war in the West? Did it have any consequence as to the ultimate outcome?
Well, when you're talking about the Civil War in the West, you have to define what is meant by the West. At the time of the Civil War, when most Americans talked about the West, they meant the United States west of the Appalachian Mountains. So that would have included Tennessee and Mississippi and Alabama and Kentucky and Louisiana and so on. And, of course, what happened in those states was crucial, absolutely crucial to the outcome of the war. But I suspect that the email refers to what we would call the West today, that is west of, not only west of the Mississippi River, but probably west of the 100th Meridian. The Battle of Glorieta Pass in New Mexico near Santa Fe is sometimes called the Gettysburg of the West. It was a victory by Union forces that turned back an invasion by Texas Confederates aimed at gaining control of New Mexico and possibly even of the gold fields in Colorado in early 1862. And the failure of that Confederate effort did play a role. I don't think it was a central role in the war, but it nevertheless was of some importance. There was a lot of fighting in what was then called Indian Territory. Today we'd call it Oklahoma. Some fighting in Texas, although Texas was largely free except along some coastal enclaves of significant fighting in the Civil War. Some important battles in Louisiana, Missouri, and Arkansas, which is yet another West during that period. I would say, though, that of the of all the theaters of the war, if we talk about east of the Appalachians, the area between the Appalachians and the Mississippi River, the area between the Mississippi River and, let's say, the 100th Meridian, which runs through the middle of Kansas and Oklahoma, and then west of that, each of these, the farther west you go, the diminishing importance of what happened there on the outcome of the war.
One of the great victories in the near or middle west, so to speak, rather than out in the Indian Territory, was the taking of Vicksburg.
Yes.
And that's where Ulysses Grant first really comes to prominence, isn't it?
That's correct. He had earlier gained some prominence by capturing Fort Donelson on the Tennessee River in early 1862, but then his star had been eclipsed for a while. And for a long time, his effort against Vicksburg was not successful, but when he did finally capture Vicksburg, and it wasn't just Vicksburg, it was also 30,000 soldiers defending Vicksburg and all of their equipment, his star was then, from then on through the end of the war, very much in the ascendant, and that probably was the most important single Union victory in the Western theater of the war.
When you talk about central, figural persons, great historical actors, obviously Grant, whom we've barely mentioned tonight, is, I suppose when it comes to generalship, the most important man in the war.
Yes, I think so. Next to Lincoln, he's certainly the most important man on the Union side in forging the victory. And I think one would include Lee then as the third figure in terms of determining the course of the war.
Do you know the wonderful imaginative counterfactual about Grant and Lee at Appomattox?
Oh, yes, that's the James Thurber essay. Yes, if Grant hadn't been drunk at Appomattox.
If Grant had been drinking at Appomattox.
Yes, he turned over his sword to Robert E. Lee and said he didn't know what he was doing, etc. Yeah, I remember reading that. It's quite funny.
Actually, just as funny as that is, wonderfully moving is the actual account written by Grant.
Yes.
Of his meeting with Lee at Appomattox.
Well, Grant wrote his memoirs 20 years after the war when he was dying. It was a race against death with death from cancer. And he won that race, just barely. He finished those memoirs just a few days before
advised he died. By Mark Twain.
Yes, Mark Twain published. Grant had been invited to write his memoirs by the Century Publishing Company. And when Mark Twain heard about that, he said, well, what kind of contract did they give you? And he said, well, 10% royalties. Mark Twain, who didn't like publishers, decided to set up his own publishing house, said, I thought they were trying to exploit you. And he had just set up his own publishing house, and the first book they published was... well, I'm not sure now which was the first one.
But this one is just called...
But Grant's memoirs.
Memoirs,
It's the personal memoirs of U.S. Grant. Hmm. It is a wonderful account of Appomattox, in which he said that he almost that he felt a little bit let down at Appomattox by this experience, even though it was the greatest moment in his
life.
But
he feels rather deferential towards Lee, who apparently was the commandant of West Point. When Grant was a student at West Point.
No, that's not quite right. Lee was the commandant of West Point, but that was in the 1850s.
It was later.
Grant graduated in 1843.
But he knew him...
In the Mexican War. That's right.
And he's very flattered and very impressed that Lee says that he remembers from the Mexican War.
Yeah. And here... Well, Grant, of course... came to that meeting at Will McLean's house in Appomattox with his fatigue uniform on, because his dress uniform hadn't kept up with him. Mm-hmm. And Lee came resplendent with a new sword, a new uniform, and so on. So there was this contrast between this scion of one of the first families of Virginia and this man from a middle-class background in Ohio and Illinois. That is a perfect metaphor for the clash between a democratic and aristocratic society, which in some ways is what the Civil War was about.
Of course, they went different ways. Grant became President of the United States, whereas Lee wound up running a university or a college.
Washington College, which after his death was renamed, Washington and Lee in Lynchburg, in Lexington, Virginia.
Does Lee have memoirs of...
No, he was planning to write his memoirs, but he died in 1870 before he had an opportunity to do so.
We must pause. We're overdue for a quick commercial break, and then back to the phones and to the email. At the moment, all the phone lines are taken. If you're trying to reach us, try again after we say goodnight to some other caller. And, of course, we have infinite capacity on the email. If you want to email us from wherever you are, the address, extension 720 at tribune.com. One account of Appomattox is that at one point Grant tells an adjutant to tell the band to play Dixie.
That's actually, no, it wasn't at Appomattox. It was at the celebration in Washington when celebrants came out to serenade Lincoln at the White House, which was a common thing then. And Lincoln said, one of my favorite songs has been Dixie, and we fairly captured it, and he asked the band to play Dixie.
Oh, it was Lincoln who asked?
It was Lincoln, yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Grant was tone deaf. He did not like music. He said it sounded like noise to him. And one of the best stories about Grant is that he only recognized two tunes. One was Yankee Doodle, and the other wasn't.
Uh-huh. We go back to the phones. 591-7200 is the number. 591-7200. And we go to this line. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. I'm calling from Milwaukee. It's a splendid program,
yes, sir,
as always. I wonder if we could just go back to Antietam for a minute. I visited there the last time, probably 10, 15 years ago. And it's just a wonderful experience, because one can tour literally the entire area. But I must admit, I only remember a few things. One was something about the cornfield. Mm-hmm. Another was something about the bloody alleys. And then there's something that I thought was pivotal called Burnside's Bridge. Can you comment on those?
Well, those are three of the most important landmarks on the battlefield. The cornfield they referred to is about a 35-acre cornfield through which the initial Union attack came in the early morning of September 17th. and there were Confederates in the cornfield and south of it, and the fighting raged back and forth across the cornfield, not only in those initial attacks, but in later ones through the morning, so that by the end of the fighting in that sector of the battlefield, it was said that you could walk through that cornfield without ever touching the ground. There were so many killed and wounded men there. Bloody Lane is the, it was a sunken farm road. It's about maybe a mile south of the cornfield, three quarters of a mile south of the cornfield. It was a, an eroded area where a farm road where farmers would take their grain to the mill, and over time it eroded down into a kind of sunken road, and it was a natural ready-made trench for Confederate defenders in that area. And it was attacked repeatedly by Union forces through the middle of the day, and they finally broke through there. Burnside's Bridge is another couple of miles south. It's on the southern part of the battlefield. It was a bridge that was there then, and the same bridge is still there now. It's called It was called the Roarback Bridge at the time, after the local farmer who had the property there. But it's been called Burnside's Bridge ever since, because Burnside wasted so much time and so many lives trying to cross that bridge in order to get at the Confederate defenders, rather than being creative and looking for a way to ford the creek and flank the Confederates. But you remember three of the outstanding landmarks on the battlefield.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. Let's go quickly to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I have three questions. The short questions. The first one is, what was the significance of the slave revolts led by John Brown and Ned Turner to the freedom of the slaves and to the victory of the North? Number two, what contributions did black regiments have in the victory for the North? And also, were there any black regiments for the Confederacy? I seem to have saw a picture one time where I saw some Africans or ex-slaves dressed in Confederate clothing and representing the South. Did that happen as well?
Well, we did address that last of your three questions already. You did say that.
Well, let me pick up, though, on that last part of the question. What you're probably talking about, what you probably saw, is after the war was over at reunions in the 1880s and 1890s, Confederates would often bring their loyal retainers, black retainers who may have been their slaves a generation earlier, to some of these Confederate reunions, and they would sometimes dress up in Confederate Union uniforms. But there were no black regiments as such in the Confederate Army. There was not, the Confederate Congress finally got around to authorizing that in the middle of March 1865, but the war was over before that could happen. To back up to your previous question, there were about 180,000 black soldiers who fought for the Union and 166 regiments. And I think they did make an important contribution to Union victory in the last year of the war. They came on in large numbers in 1864, participated in a number of important battles. Even more important, I think, they were they guarded some of the Union communications, the railroads, the bridges, the arms, the supply depots, and so on, freeing up more veteran white combat troops to fight, especially in Sherman's campaign. Lincoln himself said that he said this in August of 1864, without the contribution of black troops, we couldn't win this war.
Now, I had understood also that if Lincoln had allowed the slaves to fight earlier, then it might have made the war more decisive.
Well, that's possible. Lincoln was a master of timing. The problem was that a lot of people in the North opposed the enlistment of black troops, and if Lincoln had moved too quickly, and I think he knew this, to do that, if he had moved in 1862 or even earlier in 1861, that probably would have been counterproductive, in the sense that it would have alienated a lot of Northern Democrats who initially were strong supporters of Lincoln's war policy, but would not have supported it if it had been a war that early. The Civil War's dynamic, it kept getting more radical in its goals and in its methods as time went on. And
yeah,
one of Lincoln's key qualities as a leader was his sense of timing, his sense of knowing when to move. As far as the slave revolts, the Nat Turner Revolt and John Brown's attempt to foment a slave rebellion in 1859, I think both of those events had a lot to do with the coming of the Civil War.
Yeah.
Convincing many Southerners that their society, their civilization was under siege, and that they would be a lot better off if they seceded from the United States rather than staying in the United States, where such fanatics as they saw it, as John Brown, could lead raids from the North into the South.
Okay, I'd like to apologize to the host that I didn't hear that you had spoken on these issues before, because I just turned the radio on about 10 minutes ago.
Well, that's quite all
that's
right.
That's understandable.
It's really a great show, and I really like the Civil War. It's a fascinating war. I've always wondered why Lee was just did what he did in Gettysburg, and if that hadn't happened, would the South would have won? It's a fascinating war.
Well, it's full of all kinds of questions exactly like that, and that's what makes it fascinating.
We thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
Here's an interesting email, and it touches on matters that I don't know too much about. I wonder how accurate it is. I'm hoping you can confirm if one story about General Grant is in fact true. Before Grant and his army went south to conquer Vicksburg, he and his army occupied the area around Memphis, Tennessee. Grant was having trouble with carpetbaggers, those coming down from the north, as well as from elsewhere. Some even were smuggling arms to the rebels. Given his anti-Semitic mindset, Grant issued an order expelling Jews from his sector of Tennessee. President Lincoln, of course, overruled it as soon as a copy of the order reached him. There were roughly 10,000 Jews in the Union Army. Grant didn't even give Jews the opportunity to convert, as did Ferdinand and Isabella.
I don't know about the Ferdinand and Isabella part of it, but most of the rest of that is accurate. When Grant was commander of the Union occupation forces in the area around Memphis, there was a big problem of trade across the lines, mostly in cotton. The South had a commodity that the North much wanted, and that was cotton. The North had a commodity that the South much wanted, which was money, which the South could use to buy arms and ammunition. Whenever the Union forces moved in and conquered and occupied part of the Confederacy, one of their purposes was to resume normal trade and normal life there. And they would grant licenses to trade to merchants who came down from the North, but they were supposed to confine their trade to certain items and so on and so forth. And a lot of people were coming in and paying gold for cotton that was smuggled across the lines. And Grant had a lot of problems with that, and so did other Union forces. And there was this impression that a lot of these merchants were Jews from Cincinnati, southern Ohio.
And did he give an order expelling all Jews from?
He gave an order expelling what he called Jew peddlers.
Really?
From the lines. And it's quite true that Lincoln overruled that. And it's quite true that I think probably 10,000 is an accurate number. There were Jews fighting both sides in the American Civil War.
Oh, yeah?
Both sides, north and south.
A leading member of Jefferson Davis's cabinet.
Oh, that's right, Judah Benjamin.
It was Judah Benjamin.
That's right, that's right. I don't think Grant was particularly anti-Semitic any more than most other people were at the time. He just used this phraseology in the way that we might today say, expel all of the people who are trading with the enemy from our lines. But he did single out Jews.
America has come a long way, not only with regard to black civil rights, but with regard to other attitudes as they corrupt the language. When I was a very young assistant professor at Yale, and I just arrived there, the chairman of my department talking with me about an older fellow who was an emeritus and was going to be teaching doing a course at another nearby place where I had some friends, said, "Tell your friends over there that they shouldn't try to Jew the price down." I was astonished.
Yeah, well, I think you're right.
Absolutely. Chairman of psychology at Yale University.
Yeah, that is amazing. Yeah. But that was another age, I guess.
I used to hear that from cab drivers in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
591-7200 is the number, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
Yes. I understand that the casualty ratio was extremely high as opposed north to the south. And I was wondering, what percentage of the 600,000 casualties were northern casualties as opposed to southern? I was taught that the ratio, you know, the mortality ratio was like 6 to 1 in favor of the north, And I was wondering if there were any reason for this, if tactics or some, if there were a reason for that high ratio.
Well, that's not quite right. Of the 620,000 who died in the Civil War, 360,000 were Union, Northern, and 260,000 were Confederate.
Okay.
Now, that's actually a higher ratio for the Confederates because they had fewer men. The total number of men in the Union Army and Navy was probably about 2.1 or 2.2 million. So the 360,000 represented about 16% of all Union fighting men.
Right.
In the Confederate Army, the total number of men was between 800,000 and 900,000, so the 260,000 there represent about 32%.
Right.
So the Confederate ratio is higher, 32% to about 16%. It's almost twice as high.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you.
We thank you, sir. An email from Abilene, Kansas. The fellow says, here in Abilene, Kansas, we have a reputation that came about as the result of a 10-year span of our history caused by the fact that the North destroyed much of the railroads of the South, and thus Texas cattlemen had to bring their cattle over land to the closest railroad depot.
Well, that's mostly myth. The railroads had not yet been penetrated into the Kansas area before the Civil War. What happened was that during the war, because of the disruption, not so much the destruction of railroads. Actually, the Southern railroads did suffer a huge amount of destruction, but a lot of that was deterioration because of they didn't have replacement capacity. And just the disruption of the war itself, as well as the destruction and deterioration of the rail capacity, meant that a lot of Texas cattle, longhorn cattle, the numbers just built up through natural increase. And after the war was over and the railroad started rebuilding, they started moving west. And Abilene did enjoy about a decade of prominence because it was the railhead for the shipment eastward of cattle that had been driven north on the Overland Trail from Texas. And that would have been from the late 1860s until the late 1870s.
I want to go back to the model of history or the overarching philosophy of history that you use, and contingency is the key term. What do you call it, in fact, just the contingency model? Or?
Well, my book on Antietam is a book in a series called Pivotal Moments
yes,
in American
History. Yes, I should have noted that, indeed.
And it grew out of a series of conversations that I had with my friend David Hackett Fisher. We were fellow graduate students at Hopkins back in the late 50s, early 60s. And he's taught at Brandeis ever since, and I've taught at Princeton ever since. He's a Princeton alumnus. He's done a book called Paul Revere's Ride, which has won a lot of notice. It came out about 10 years ago.
He writes the introduction to this volume.
And he writes the introduction to this volume. These books in this series, Pivotal Moments, are based on the theme of contingency. That is that people make choices, or chance intervenes in historical development, and that these choices and chance have consequences that might turn out to be major turning points
exactly.
in American history. So each of the books in this series is about some key pivotal moment.
What are some of the other books?
Well, he's writing one himself, David, right now on Washington's decision to cross the Delaware River and
uh-huh.
attack Trenton. The day after Christmas.
Which may have been the turning point in that war.
It was a turning point in the American Revolution, and that was a result of a series of decisions, as well as the fact that there was a garrison there in Trenton. It did turn the corner in the American Revolution. Two books that preceded mine in the series, one was on the Supreme Court's 1954 desegregation decision, Brown versus Board of Education, which was, of course, a key pivotal moment,
mm-hmm.
a key turning point in civil rights. And the other is called, I'm blanking on the title right now, but it's about the great stock market crash in 1920, Rainbow's End, mm-hmm. by Maury Klein. And it's a key moment in the history of American economy and American capitalism.
I should make clear, I haven't said this often enough, that the title of the new book by James McPherson, this is about your 15th or 16th book, I should think.
Somewhere in that vicinity, yes.
The title is Crossroads of Freedom, Antietam, and it is published by Oxford University Press. How does that model, how does that way of thinking apply to the present moment? You can't simply draw lessons from history and apply them to the contemporaneous situation. But what does our fate at the moment hinge upon? Or what are the hinges for the world's future?
Well, of course, the events of September 11th, 2001 were a huge shock, and I think a huge turning point. It's created what we call the war on terrorism now, and I think it probably was this what grew out of that event or events has really dominated the history of the world since then, and may continue to do so for some time. What we're facing right now is a series of foreign policy decisions on the Middle East, on Israel and Palestine and Iraq, and now North Korea has entered into it, and people will be making decisions on what to do about all these things, and they will affect the course of world history for a long time to come.
Years ago, the American Psychiatric Association ran a sort of a study section on, I think the title for it was the VIP as psychotic, or was it the psychotic as VIP? But interested in the question of what people who've slipped away from the bounds of ordinary rationality and yet are in positions of high power, of how they enact their psychoses upon the world in a way that usually is injurious, or maybe sometimes is beneficial by accident. Is that a category of analysis worth applying when one looks at the world today?
I don't personally know enough about Saddam Hussein or about Kim Jong in North Korea to say whether these are psychotic personalities whose idiosyncrasies or whose psychoses are going to have a huge impact on the world. They may be perfectly rational people who are being whose personalities are being distorted by the news media or by the propaganda machine. I really don't know, but it's at least a plausible interpretation. I remember at the time of the Gulf War, a decade ago, Saddam Hussein was being compared to Hitler. He was a kind of minor league Hitler. So clearly that notion is out there, and maybe he would fit your American Psychological or Psychiatric Association.
It was the psychiatrist.
Yeah, psychiatrist.
Who presumed to
know these things.
And presumed very often to do personality interpretation at a distance. Indeed, the CIA, as you know, during the war established an office that was supposed to analyze all the world leaders, including Hitler and Stalin and so on, at a distance. And to a fellow named Langer,
William Langer, was
a psychoanalyst. Came up with a major study of Hitler based merely upon what he could gather over here, looking on and reading whatever was available.
Yep. That's right.
I'm rather convinced that Stalin, at least in his old age, was seriously psychotic.
Well, I think that most people have come to that conclusion now, including starting with Khrushchev himself revealed Stalin's crimes back in the 1950s.
I see we're late for another last batch of commercials. We'll take care of those and then directly back to the phones and the email. Another one of the less well-known Civil War songs, Hail Columbia.
Yes, it was very popular in the 1850s and 1860s, and of course it's a good example of the way in which that generation looked back on the founders' generation as the greatest generation from their point of view.
Here's another email, interesting one. My great-grandfather fought at Shiloh and defended the Hornet's Nest. What can you tell me about this?
Well, Shiloh was a battle fought along the Tennessee River in April of 1862 as the Union forces were moving south toward invading Mississippi, capturing Corinth, Mississippi, and it represented an effort by the Confederates to undertake a counteroffensive against Grant's army camped along the Tennessee River near a church called Shiloh Church. It was a bloody two-day battle. In those 2 days at Shiloh, the total number of casualties were about the same as they were in 1 day at Antietam, about 23,000. The Hornet's Nest was a Union position in the center of the battlefield that the Confederates attacked and finally encircled and captured about 2,500 Union forces who had defended it. But it was crucial to the outcome of the battle because it bought Grant time to set up a strong defense along a ridge line a couple of miles farther back. So it was sacrificial fighting by your great-grandfather and several thousand other Union troops that may have saved the day for the Union forces.
What sort of army did we field in terms of, say, social class and, for that matter, ethnic origins? Is it true that a large number of middle-class people who had some sufficient fortune could buy their way out and did buy their way out?
It was possible to buy your way out of the draft, but that creates a kind of distorted impression of the class composition of the armies in both North and South. In the first place, 80 to 90% of the soldiers in this war were volunteers. Both sides enacted a draft partway through the war, and in the case of the Union Army, not until halfway through the war. But most of them, both sides depended primarily on volunteers, and even the draft was designed to induce volunteering rather than actually create armies from conscription. There have been some studies, and I participated in one of these myself, of the social composition of both the Union and ethnic composition of both the Union and Confederate armies, and they pretty faithfully reflect the social and ethnic composition of the societies in terms of class, in terms of regional background, in terms of ethnicity. So it was because the war mobilized such a large percentage, it mobilized a larger percentage of the eligible male population than any other war this country has fought except World War II.
How did you get drafted into Civil War scholarship?
How did I get drafted? I was a graduate student in Baltimore in the early years of the Civil Rights Movement.
At Hopkins.
Yeah. And I was caught up in some of the civil rights activity in that border city. And I was suddenly struck by the similarities between the times in which I was living and the events of exactly 100 years earlier. Confrontation between the United States government and Southern political leaders in the 1960s who were vowing massive resistance to national law. Federal troops being sent into Little Rock, into Oxford, Mississippi, and other parts of the South to enforce national law. Martin Luther King trying to prevail upon President Kennedy to issue a new Emancipation Proclamation on the 100th anniversary of the original one. Kennedy didn't, but King went ahead and organized the March on Washington in August 1863, which took place where? At the Lincoln Memorial.
Were you there?
I was there.
So was I. I didn't see you.
Well, there were only 200,000 of us there. But I was struck by the parallels between the time in which I was living and the historical roots of the 1960s in the events of the 1860s. And so I decided to do my doctoral dissertation on the people I saw as the civil rights activists of the 1860s, the abolitionists, both black and white. So that was my dissertation and my first book, which was called The Struggle for Equality.
And you never really left the Civil War after that?
Not really. I traced some of these people on through the end of the 19th century and the founding of the NAACP in the early 20th century. So that took me away from the actual years of the Civil War for a major research effort. But then I eventually found my way back to the Civil War years.
I once asked a literary scholar whose field was British literature mid to late 18th century, and an eminent fellow who'd done a lot of writing and knew everything about that period. I once asked him, don't you ever feel in a way frustrated that you're living here rather than there? Would you like to go back and live there for a year? And his answer was, good God, no, there was no dental anesthesia.
Well, there was by the time of the Civil War, but there were a lot of other things they didn't
have. But you see what I'm leading to?
Yes, I
do. Do you ever feel kind of a longing to go back to that, to be in that time?
Now and then, in a kind of fantasy way, I do. Yeah. It would have been interesting and challenging to live in those times. One of my research projects was the study of Civil War soldiers and their motivations, mm-hmm. or their perceptions of what they were fighting for and why they were fighting. And to do that research, my wife and I read thousands and thousands of Civil War soldiers' letters. And that's the closest I've ever gotten to being able to project myself back into a different time, a different milieu, through reading the very personal letters of these
people. In
fact,
your various books, and the new one, Crossroads of Freedom, Antietam, is rich with material of that sort.
I do use a lot of that kind of material in this book, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just as that fellow Burns, for whom you were a consultant, weren't you?
Yes, Ken Burns used a lot of letters. In fact, that's what gave that television documentary so much power, I think, was the contemporary voices.
Was it you who turned up that one that he used at the very end?
You're probably thinking the one that he used at the very beginning, Major Sullivan Ballou.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes, no, I didn't turn that up. There's a lot of controversy about that letter. The letter that he used, which actually comes from the Chicago Historical Society, it now appears was a copy made by his widow years after the war, in which she actually improved the language somewhat.
Oh, dear.
The original, which had the same sentiments but not in such eloquent language, turned up at the either at the Rhode Island Historical Society or maybe it was at Brown University. But it doesn't matter. I mean, that letter is a powerful example. And I read many letters that were equally eloquent, that were genuine.
We'll go back to the phones for one or two more quick calls. Good evening. You're on the air.
Oh, hello?
Yes.
Dr. Rosenberg and Mr. McPherson, wonderful program. This is my kind of program. And Mr. McPherson, every time you're on my book TV, I always tape you. And I have a question about, is there somewhere a National Registry or the like that has a compilation of all those who served in the Confederacy? Because I'm doing sort of genealogical research.
Well, most southern states at one time or another since the war published rosters of all of the soldiers that served from that state. And now there's something called the Civil War Soldiers and Sailors Database Project that's putting all of the records that we have. The records are more complete for the Union Army and Navy than they are for the Confederacy, but they're pretty complete for the Confederacy, too, into a national electronic database.
Okay.
The Mormon Church is part of this, the American Genealogical Society is part of this, and so are the United Daughters of the Confederacy. And I'm not sure how you can, they do have a website, but I can't tell you what it is.
Okay, one more quick question. I have heard from a reputable television program that the Confederates were better sharpshooters by far than those of the Yankees.
Well, I don't think you could necessarily make that case on the. They may have had a higher percentage of men who were experienced in handling firearms when the war began. But
right.
The Union Army did raise two whole regiments called Berdan sharpshooters. Who were very effective skirmishers. Now, the Confederates had a number of companies or individuals who were very good sharpshooters, but I think probably at least by the second or third year of the war, those skills were pretty equal on both sides.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, ma'am, for the call. I've got a most interesting email here, and I rather think that, I'll tell you what I think after I read the first sentence or two. Very interesting program as usual. Thank you for that. Milt is always that bit of counterfactuals, and I recently read a book entitled What If, which was a series of counterfactual histories of various great events. One pertained to Antietam, and the main theme was that the Lost Order was not, in fact, lost. I have a suspicion that you wrote that chapter.
Yes, I'm very familiar with that article. I wrote it.
You told me earlier that you had a chapter in
that
book.
I wrote it, yes.
Mm-hmm. Let me read on quickly. As a result, Lee is able to continue his invasion of the North unencumbered, and McClellan follows with his usual lethargy. The climax of the campaign is that Lee has entrenched his force in the high ground south of a convenient nearby rail junction known as Gettysburg. In effect, the roles are reversed, and the North is forced to attack entrenched southern forces and is badly defeated. Lee takes advantage of this opportunity, counterattacks, routs the Army of the Potomac. The follow-up is that Washington is besieged, the Republicans lose badly in the 1862 elections and are forced to sue for peace, which results in southern independence. your guest comments are appreciated.
I think it's a wonderful article. Since I wrote it, that was my attempt to deal with the counterfactual of the sort we
and
were
is,
talking about
is
earlier.
Is this summarized correctly?
Pretty correctly, yes. Yeah. Yes, I talk about the Battle of Gettysburg that took place in 1862 with the roles reversed. I have McClellan being killed in the final moments of the battle, which is an interesting twist. But, yeah, she had, the person had it about right.
Yeah. I must get my hands on that book. It's it follows upon an earlier book that had the same title, I think.
The one that you mentioned, the Churchill and so on.
Yeah, when we were talking privately.
I don't know if it was called What If, or maybe you're right.
Maybe just If.
If. I think you're probably right. It was just If.
There was a wonderful piece in it, I forget who wrote it, about Louis the 16th and Marie Antoinette and their children escaping from Paris, as they attempted to do. And they were stopped at Varennes and discovered, because they were going incognito, turned back, and that led to ultimately their execution and their trial and execution. But in this what if, the man who did in fact discover them somehow is waylaid or delayed and doesn't catch them, and they get out of France. And then, of course, what follows is the organization, inspired by Louis the 16th, of a great army to come in and suppress the revolution.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of like my article on Antietam. Yep.
Yeah. So there is no order to history. History is accident as much as anything else.
Well, I sometimes think that's exactly right, that we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, and it could entirely change the course of history. It may not be accident, but it would be, I think a better word might be chance.
Yeah.
So I'm very much open to that to that notion that there is that history is disorder.
Well, you certainly make a very persuasive case for just that, and at the same time a very compelling historian of the great American bloodletting, the great American test which I guess we passed, though the reverberations are still sometimes rather
still
difficult.
With us today.
And the new book by James McPherson that we've been drawing from is Crossroads of Freedom, Antietam, published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me again.
It's been a great pleasure to have you here.
I enjoyed it.
And please, anytime. We are going on with taking advantage of the presence of the American Historical Association. I should have added that James McPherson is about to be inducted as the new president of the AHA, and we'll have other historians with us tomorrow night talking about the craft of the historian. Until tomorrow at 9, thanks to all for listening, and a cordial good night.